Mic one. Mic number one. Hello, this is... Let's see, what is this? This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, which is broadcasting at 101.3 FM on your radio dial. There's also this great new thing. It's called the Internet. On this other great new thing, it's called the personal computer or tablet or whatever else you use, which means you can pick us up streaming at www.freakradio.org. And it's 3 o'clock, time for Mideast Madness. Check that, folks. It's still time for Mideast Madness, but it is 3:02. I'm Ren Tuwiel. We shall get going presently here. Let me just find a nice tune for us all to enjoy. Number 11. And off we go.
المطربة المحبوبة كهرمان
This is Ren Tuwiel, and we're doing Mideast Madness now until 4:55. Till 4:55 Pacific Standard Time. Turn that sucker off there. And yes, this is that more or less new radio show on Pirate Radio here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. That new show that is hosted by a Palestinian American, yours truly. My name is Ren Arien, and I talk about the big capital C conflict out in the Middle East. It's there are those who may say, well, the big conflict in the Middle East is currently Afghanistan, or is the potential war between Iran and Israel. But that's all that stuff is actually a sideshow when you put it up against the fight between Israel and Palestine, Israelis and Palestinians. So I'm giving you, without question, my slant on what's going on. And let me get a couple of PSAs out of the way first. This is Pirate Public Radio, underground radio, which is simply not on the receiving end, cannot be on the receiving end of any corporate or sugar daddy donations and grants and things. We really need your help and support, like so many others out there who are crying for donations. Please give something. Consider sending your check or money order, probably not cash in the mail, it's up to you. Send them to Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95066. That's P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, S-A-N-T-A-C-R-U-Z, California, 95061. Here on the west coast of the Americas. Let me go ahead and give you, as long as you got a pencil and paper in hand there, I'll give you the phone numbers, which go directly to me, directly to the live studio here. You will be on the air, and I shall answer your phones, if you care to call. Area code 831-427-3772. That's line one. Line two is also area 831-469-3119. Those are the phone numbers. You can also go to our website at freakradio.org. I can't remember offhand if the phone numbers are listed there, but if you missed them just now, you can pick them up at our website, freakradio.org. We are, as I indicated, in the midst of a conflict which has been going on most markedly since May or so, the spring of 1948. That's the year that the State of Israel came into being. Now we're going to take a close look at the one of the glorious shining lights of Israel, namely its purported democracy. This is an important piece for Mr. Jeff Halper, who is... Okay, it's called The Israeli Elections... No, I'm sorry, I'll start over again. Important piece from Mr. Jeff Halper. The Israeli elections tell us that for the great majority of Israelis, the question of peace with the Palestinians is irrelevant. Now first, let me tell you a little bit about Jeff Halper. I met Jeff Halper in 2008. It was actually around the beginning of August 2008 in Larnaca, Cyprus, because we were all getting ready to sail off to the Gaza Strip in two old resurrected Greek fishing boats, the SS Free Gaza and the SS Liberty. We did so eventually waiting for the boats, which had a lot of difficulty making their way from northern Greece, between Greece and Turkey, by way of unannounced stops, including Crete, Greece's largest island. On their way to Cyprus, they eventually made it, and we climbed on board, and then we headed out and landed in the port of Gaza in Gaza City. This is 2008 now. At the time, the Israeli Navy vowed, as I kept reading it, vowed to stop us because they were maintaining an economic siege against the Gaza Strip, have since almost immediately after, the Israeli settlements in Gaza were dismantled and abandoned. And this economic stranglehold on the Gaza Strip persists today. So, the Israeli Navy swore that they would stop us, vowed that they would stop us, never let it happen. They didn't want us to mess up their party, their squeeze on the Palestinian people there. But in the nick of time, world opinion chimed in and strongly advised Israel not to stop us, as this was quite obviously and most honestly a human rights issue, and what we were doing was essentially a humanitarian cause. So the Navy relented, and we sailed unhindered into the port of Gaza City. Anyway, getting back to Jeffrey and I met there in actually Nicosia, Cyprus, where we were stationed that particular time. You see, Jeff Halper is a Minnesota-born and raised, for the most part, American Jew who became an Israeli citizen. I believe he's currently still in Jerusalem, lives in Jerusalem. Jeff Halper is the director of ICAD, which is the International Committee Against House Demolitions, the Israeli authorities, which is to say, generally, the Israeli Defense Forces, as they call themselves, they have bulldozers, armored bulldozers, like the one that killed Rachel Corrie a while back, that just tear down these houses. And they've been doing a lot more of it. There have been well over 2,700 house demolitions since 1967, all Palestinian homes, domiciles, residences that were torn down. They used to give the excuse that these were the homes of terrorists or terrorist aider and abettors. But lately they've been doing it pretty much because they feel like it. They feel these homes are in the way for military bases or for the expansion of Israeli Jewish settlements. And I remember when we visited Rafah on the Egyptian border there in the Gaza Strip, we saw just about a mile-long strip that was all completely nothing but rubble. I mean, nothing's even there now, but all these homes were torn down, which supposedly had something to do with the establishment of a secure gate to the south into or from Egypt. Of course, the real reason why Israel does this is they're trying to drive the Palestinians out so they can claim what they consider to be Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. This is a very strong method of expanding Zionism for Jews and for Jews only. So anyway, Jeff Halper and I Jeff walked up to me because I had lived in the Twin Cities in Minnesota for 35 years and was residing there. I maintained a home there while I was in Cyprus and Gaza. And Jeffrey found out that I was more or less the Minnesota representative from the United States. Jeff walks up and says, hi, hey, I'm a native of northern Minnesota. He grew up there somewhere on or near the range, the great Mesabi Range, you know, iron ore and all that, from northern Minnesota. And I soon found out, but it took a very long time for me to appreciate the situation. It took a long time for it to sink in that Jeff Halper, as busy a man, as busy a humanitarian as he is, director of ICAD, was once, not too long ago, nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He was a nominee. Of course, he did not end up winning that prize. It's, in my mind, it's virtually impossible for anyone who supports Palestinians, especially if they're an Israeli Jew to begin with, to win a Nobel Prize. But this is a busy boy. Jeff has written many articles for a number of publications. This one came out on the 27th, which was yesterday, Sunday. And let's see if I can find out the source material here. Okay, this was sent to me by way of my good friend Pastor Darrell. All it says is Jeff Halper is the director of the Israeli, I'm sorry, I said International Committee. He is the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, ICAD. And he can be reached at jeff@icahd.org. Now, you may be aware that elections were held in Israel about a week ago or so. Of course, garnering fully one quarter of the total vote, Mr. Netanyahu's Likud party was given the thumbs up by those in Israel who care to vote. And my understanding is they do not vote for candidates. They vote for parties. So the right-wing Likud party, which has hosted a number of sinister leaders, prime ministers, in the last 30 years or so, was maintained in power. And Benjamin Netanyahu will continue to be prime minister until God knows when. So, Jeffrey Halper writes this article, "The Israeli Elections, the Ball is in Our Court." And here we go. So, what do the elections, quote, tell us? Do Israelis want peace or not? This is the central question people abroad ask, but if anything, the Israeli elections tell us that, for the high majority of Israelis, the question is irrelevant. Who cares? Netanyahu's party, the Likud, L-I-K-U-D in English, got less than a quarter of the vote, and the, quote, center, the largest, quote, bloc, about a third of the vote. But peace, as such, was not a campaign issue for any of the parties. Nor occupation, which, by the way, is a term never used in mainstream Israeli discourse, and he italicizes the word never. Or Arabs, the term Israeli Jews use for Palestinians within the 1967 borders and without. And the three Arab, quote-unquote, Arab parties, political parties, got less than 10% of the vote. Okay, with all my provisos and explanations chopping that sentence up, I'll read that sentence again. But, quote, peace, end quote, was not a campaign issue for any of the parties, nor occupation, a term never used in mainstream Israeli discourse, or Arabs. It was not a campaign issue. And Arabs is the term Israeli Jews use for Palestinians within the 1967 borders and without. And he notes here that the three Arab political parties got less than 10% of the vote. The fact that, quote, security, which is Israeli's euphemism for keeping the Palestinians at bay, was not even an issue, shows how far down the road the pacification and normalization of the occupation Israelis feel they have gone. Once, quote, the Arabs fail to threaten us, they become a non-issue. And if anything, this was an election of non-issues, an assertive affirmation of neoliberalism by a white middle class for whom, quote, social justice means affordable housing for its children. Did Israelis move from the right to the center? Again, an irrelevant question. Except for the small, if vocal, ideological left and right and the ultra-Orthodox religious, most Israelis have always been in the center, in a place where a determined effort to achieve normality and an American standard of living breaks through whenever pressing security concerns abate. In fact, this is the essence of the deal struck between Israeli political leaders and the public. This is the essence. If you bring us personal security, normalcy, and a rising quality of life, we will vote for you, and we don't care how you do it. Most Israeli Jews were never really right-wing in their political views. They never brought into the greater land of Israel ideology of Begin, Sharon, and Netanyahu. The ideological settlers, he italicizes ideological here, settlers represent only about 1% of Israelis. 90% of those living across the Green Line are there for economic reasons and would be willing to move back into Israel if their quality of life did not suffer. And so the mainstream voted against Peres, who is Israel's current president. Peres the president, Netanyahu the prime minister. The prime minister in a parliamentary system is generally the one who has the real power. And so the mainstream voted against Peres in the wake of the Hamas bus bombings of 1996. Voted overwhelmingly for Barak. That would be Ehud Barak in 1999. Ehud Barak was a Labor Party prime minister in Israel in 1999 when they thought the two-state solution would finally bring peace. Or rather, quiet normalcy. And just a year later, they bolted for Sharon, a seemingly 180-degree turn after the Second Intifada broke out and he promised to break Palestinian resistance forever. Sharon did. In the view of the Israeli Jewish public, Sharon succeeded in doing just that. In Operation Defensive Shield in 2002, and ever since they have voted, quote, right, not out of ideological conviction, but for those who could deliver personal security. As that concern dwindled over the past decade, incidentally, 2012 was the first year since 1973 in which no Israeli civilian died in an attack. In the occupied territory, beyond Israel's Green Line. As that concern dwindled over the past decade, priority shifted. Now, economic well-being was what politicians had to deliver, and hence the rise of the neoliberal, quote, center. To remind you, I am reading the words of Jeff Halper, The Israeli Elections, The Ball is in Our Court. Jeff Halper is an Israeli and an American Jew. Jeff Halper, born in the USA. Continuing with the article. Why, then, haven't Israelis simply voted for a government that would genuinely end the occupation and bring them peace? And with that, personal security and economic prosperity. Three main reasons. First, for generations, Israeli Arabs have been convinced by their political leaders, right and left, that peace with, quote, the Arabs is impossible. The Arabs are our permanent enemies, goes the line, or in more popular terms, you can't trust the Arabs. Though deeply embedded in the Israeli Jewish psyche, it is possible to overcome this way of thinking. After all, two-thirds or more of the Israeli Jewish public, up to 80% of Israelis, if its Palestinian citizens are factored in, supported the Oslo peace process. Only 3 weeks ago, a poll showed that the majority of Israelis who vote for the right support a two-state solution, at least in principle. I'll read that sentence again. Only 3 weeks ago, a poll showed that the majority of Israelis who vote for the right, as in right wing, support a two-state solution, at least in principle. True, this is very much in principle, since Israeli Jews, with little knowledge of Israeli policies in the occupied territory, have no clear idea of what a genuine two-state solution would actually entail, which is to say, the relinquishing of East Jerusalem, the large settlement blocks, or Hebron, for example. And I think what Jeff Halper here is saying, the evacuation and dismantlement of the settlement blocks. And in the case of Hebron, reestablishment of equality and peace in the city of Hebron, which is a very sacred city for both Jews and Muslims. Continuing, but it does demonstrate, however, that Israelis are not ideologically dedicated to the occupation, and in the right circumstances, be it a combination of good Israeli and Palestinian leadership or strong outside pressures, they could be induced to give it up. Fearing this for reasons of their own, then, successive Israeli governments have rendered a genuine peace impossible by laying massive facts on the ground, as it were, quote-unquote, facts on the ground over the occupied territory that have raised the stakes to a point where the concessions necessary to create a viable and truly sovereign Palestinian state are impossible to imagine. When you consider that a Labor Party defense minister, Ehud Barak, refused to remove five settler families from a blatantly illegal and strategically superfluous, quote, outpost, end quote, and sought retroactive approval for 100 other illegal outposts, can anyone envision the evacuation of 45,000 Israelis from Ma'ale Adumim, or a full 250,000, quarter of a million, from East Jerusalem? Indeed, a consensus exists among parties from the extreme right to Labor, and even Meretz, to a considerable degree, forgive me, I do not know who Meretz is, that the settlement blocks, the Jordan Valley, virtually emptied of Palestinian farmers, the Ariel, Modi'in, and Hebron blocks, and greater, quote-unquote, Jerusalem, must remain in Israeli hands no matter what, effectively forecloses any contiguous and viable Palestinian state. Reading from Jeff Halper's article from yesterday. Please continue to bear with me. He's a very smart man. He knows what he's talking about. He does tend to have long, somewhat run-on sentences. Continuing. Finally, as the election demonstrates, Israelis have no motivation to end the, quote, occupation, end quote. And most Israeli Jews would put quotation marks around that dubious word. Dubious to the Israeli Jews. It does not affect their daily lives, and just as important, it does not affect their ability to achieve economic prosperity. The first decision of the leaders of the social justice protests in the summer of 2011 was to exclude all reference to the occupation, which was considered a, quote, divisive issue and not integral to social justice within Israel. He italicizes within Israel, a position the Labor Party explicitly restated during the election campaign. In fact, as the laboratory where arms, homeland security devices, and other high-tech technologies are developed and marketed, it could be argued that a prosperous Israeli economy, in italics, depends upon continued occupation. Striking sentence. I'll read that again. In fact, as the laboratory, in singular, where arms, homeland security devices, and other high-tech technologies are developed and marketed, it could be argued that a prosperous Israeli economy depends upon continued occupation. That means occupation of the part of historic Palestine outside the 1967 boundary green line. Continuing, in the end, the Israeli Jewish public will not be a fatal obstacle to a negotiated solution if that solution embodies two states, but neither will it be proactive, rising up to overthrow the occupation. The Israelis have learned to accommodate to it and can live with that not to semi-issue for another 65 years. Only determined international pressures will move intransigent Israeli governments. But if that happens, the Israeli public will come along. Last paragraph here. That's the good news. The bad news is that the two-state solution is dead, buried under settlements and infrastructure too massive and interlinked with Israel to detach, especially given the lack of will among international governments, led by the United States and Germany, to exert the pressures on Israel needed to force such massive concessions. But the international community will not move beyond the two-state solution unless prodded, virtually forced, by us, the international civil society. We have the wind to our back. Over the years, we have collectively transformed the Palestine issue into one of the world's great causes at the level of the anti-apartheid struggle. But we must show the way, led by our Palestinian partners, into envisioning a new solution, more just and more doable, with the input of their critical Israeli counterparts and their international supporters. Some version of a one-state solution or regional confederation we will have to overcome the irrelevancies of both Israeli and international politics. If the Israeli election, quote, tells us anything, it is that the ball is in our court. End of article. So, what I see in this, particularly towards the end of the article, is a Jeff Helper who is, as ever, vigilant in seeking support and donations. I do get snail mail from his outfit, too, which has an office in North Carolina. But, of course, ICAD is the Israeli Committee to... I'm not even saying it right. The ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, is centered in Jerusalem, Israel, Palestine. And Mr. Helper is giving a mighty pitch for his cause, which is the cause of peace, which is the cause of justice for Palestinians and for his fellow Israelis. He does a pretty good job. But we all knew that stuff to begin with, right? A lot of this is kind of water under the bridge. I want to read you something that I read a couple of weeks ago from a little informational card which is put out by the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz. In confederation with WILF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Jeffrey talks about how intractable the massive attachments are. He's talking about physical infrastructure attachments as well as population attachments into the occupied territories. That immediately brings to mind two very telling quotes, both from Ariel Sharon. This is something that former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said in 1998. Quote, "Everybody has to move, run, and grab as many hilltops as they can. Everything we don't grab will go to them," end quote. And he, this was 98, when obviously when Mr. Sharon was addressing or being interviewed about the situation there, which involved Mr. Yasser Arafat of the PLO. And following the creation of the Israeli and U.S. sanctioned Palestinian Authority, there was some movement in land exchanges and a reduction, ever so slight as it was, of Israeli settlements, or at least the expansion of Israeli settlements. Here's Sharon running around saying to his fellow Israelis, "Hey, everybody has to move, run, and grab as many hilltops as they can. Everything we don't grab will go to them." The other quote from Mr. Sharon is stated to have occurred in 1973, which was a war year. A year in which a war initiated by Egypt, very rare for an Arab country to initiate hostilities against Israel. And this was said to Winston Churchill III. Listen to this, folks. Quote, "We'll make a pastrami sandwich of them. We'll insert a strip of Jewish settlement in between the Palestinians and then another strip of Jewish settlement right across the West Bank so that in 25 years' time, neither the United Nations nor the United States, nobody will be able to tear it apart." End quote, Ariel Sharon. And as you heard me read from Jeff Halper here, he's talking about an infrastructure situation where you have so many ties, physical roads, barriers, connections to settlements, security walls and fences, links to new military bases, extensions of military bases. As Mr. Sharon said, in 25 years' time, no one is going to be able to extricate us from it. No one can tear it apart. This prophecy became all too true. And, my friends, to me, this is the sum and substance of the Zionist philosophy. Get it done any way you can. The end justifies the means towards establishing an exclusively Jewish presence in Palestine, or as they would say, the land of Israel, Eretz Israel. We want to leave the land Goyim Rein, which is either Hebrew or Yiddish or both, for free of Arabs. Goyim Rein, free of the Arabs. They'll do what they can to get rid of the Arabs. Okay, it is 3:41 Pacific Standard Time here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, broadcasting on that spectrum, and we're also streaming live at Freak Radio, that's FreakRadio, freakradio.org. I'll give the phone numbers again. You hearing me out there? Giving you plenty of time to prepare. Get your writing implements and parchments out. Call me now. If you agree, you want to make a comment. If you virulently disagree, if you want to fight over the air, just please don't blow my ears out with your voice, your volume level. Call me at area code 831-427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. If you're listening to me, I would like to hear from you anyway. It's nice to know that someone's listening. I'm going to adjust the microphones here. You're going to hear a bunch of squeaky noises here. Loosen, tighten up. Yeah, it looks a little more secure. Okay, we're cooking. Let us check the Shoutcast status here and see if anyone else has joined us online. Reloading page. And no, it doesn't seem that any more people have joined us. I guess that's not very likely on underground radio for someone to join midstream. Intentionally, anyway, to a specific show. Okay. Another musical interlude, and then we'll get into part two of today's lesson. Or reading.
اسطوانات الشرق تقاسيم على العود للأستاذ جليل عزوز.
Just in case you're wondering, this is called in Arabic Taksim al-Oud, or improvisation on the oud. The oud is the predecessory instrument to the European lute, with a big fat body, looks like a gigantic mandolin. Doesn't sound terribly different either. Says here, Jalil Azouz began his professional career as a versatile instrumentalist and composer at the radio station Al Sharq sorry, Al-Sharq al-Adna in Palestine. Put that to rest. Like the couple, Sana and Amir Kadaj, he traveled to North America to entertain the immigrant community and also stayed on for the rest of his life. Azouz eventually made his way to Detroit, Michigan, where he has been an invaluable artistic leader there for over 50 years. Abouz has planned countless programs, rehearsed hundreds of musicians, taught many oud and violin players, and has continued to teach, practice, and perform long after his alleged retirement. This solo that you just heard, Takasim, in Magam Nahawan, reveals the lucidity of his oud playing as well as his innovative musicianship. So, and there's a lot more on the piece, too. Here we're talking about Arabs who became Arab Americans, bringing their culture over to North America. The piece, Takasim al-Oud, is taken from the record album, although this is the compactest version, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, 1997 Rounder Records. Yes, folks, it's virtually the only album that I play on this program. And there's tons and tons and tons of CDs and vinyl on shelves all around me. I haven't even begun to look through them, but I'm happy with the music that I bring. I hope you are, too. Give me a call at 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. Tell your friends and family. In that last article, the Israeli elections, the ball is in our court now. Jeff Halper talked about, he gave an example of a specific Jewish settlement which is founded illegally on Palestinian land, against international law, international agreement. He mentioned, looking for the sentence, he says, quote, can anyone envision the evacuation of 45,000 Israelis from Ma'ale Adumim, or a full a quarter of a million from East Jerusalem? Ma'ale Adumim happens to be the settlement in occupied Palestine, which has an industrial park called West Bank Mishor Adumim Industrial Park. That's where they make Soda Stream, as it's called here, in places where it's sold in Santa Cruz County. Soda Stream is a kitchen appliance that fizzes water for you so you can make your own soda. Sounds innocent enough. The only problem is it's made in that illegal Israeli settlement, Ma'ale Adumim. Products made in West Bank settlements are illegally illegally seized Palestinian land, water, and minerals. Exploitation of natural resources in occupied territories, militarily occupied territories, is not allowed by international law. The establishment of civilian populations in occupied territory alone is not allowed by international law. Now they're expropriating the mineral and water wealth of land where very poor Palestinians live outside of Israel, but which Israel controls. Now, I've been told, in which case, if this is true, I need to apologize. I have said in the past that Palestinians get absolutely nothing out of this enterprise. they weren't involved in the decision to erect the industrial part or to manufacture the product and market it. I have said Palestinians have nothing to do with it. Well, as it turns out, apparently, there are Palestinians, non-Jewish, non-Israeli citizens, residents of the occupied West Bank who are employed by the factory. But, as one can well imagine, they are overworked and underpaid. Work very long hours, probably more hours than is permitted by Israeli law, let alone international law. And they get the short end of the stick in terms of anything that they're paid in their wages. The point is, this is, SodaStream is an excellent example of how one nation, which constantly boasts about its right to be here, to be on this earth as a state, nation state, can exploit a situation of territory and of mineral wealth and raise up their own economy at the expense of local Arabs. The international boycott of firms that supported apartheid in South Africa helped to overturn that racist regime. We can do it again. Ahava, or Ahava, a Hebrew word, is another product or shelf full of products, beauty products, as I understand. Perhaps some may have certain health benefits that are also manufactured in illegal Israeli settlements. I've used that phrase over and over again. Anyway, the Resource Center for Nonviolence Palestine-Israel Action Committee is focusing on those two as examples of this illegal activity that the world overall should be paying more attention to. So, for more information, go to www.boycottsodastream.org. Boycottsodastream.org. And there's my PSA for the boycott against SodaStream. Besides, they're really expensive. I've seen them on the store shelves. Okay, it's 6 minutes before 4 o'clock, 1554 hours Pacific time here on the west coast of the Americas. For much of the remaining time on the show, if not all of it, I want to read from you, this is very exciting, a summary of a book written by a Jewish professor. The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine came out a few years ago, written by Mr. Ilan Pape, former resident of Israel, and one man who is a member of the Palestine-Israel Action Committee in Santa Cruz, was so moved by this book, he saw it as a single, concise history and explanation of the problems between Palestinians and Israelis, so moved that he wrote a brief summary of Ilan Pape's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. It is a publication of the Palestine-Israel Action Committee of the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz, California. This summary is dedicated to the countless number of human beings who have suffered in this violent ethnic cleansing and other crimes against humanity. There are at least two sides to every story, and this one is no exception. Innocent Israelis and Palestinians have endured enough violence. However, the Palestinian side of this tragic story has been ignored for more than six decades by United States mainstream media and in high school and college textbooks. Palestinians continue to live under the threat of extrajudicial killings, confiscation of land and buildings, demolition of their homes. Where have we heard that from? Indefinite incarceration without charges and other forms of collective punishment. There can be no justice until the suffering of the Palestinians ends and until they are accorded the same rights as their Israeli neighbors. Now, okay, I don't see his name appearing here, the author of the summary of the book. So I'll respect that and not even give you his first name, but I will say that this individual read from this very document. Not the whole thing, but a few months ago, he's the one and only, well, not the one and only guest, he was a guest that I had here on Mideast Madness, and he read from the document. In fact, I think it was one of his final drafts before the printing of the summary. So, if you're listening to the show today or whenever and happen to be listening to that show or a rerun of it, same guy. And this is Ren Tawil speaking on Mideast Madness, and I shall be reading from a brief summary of Ilan Pappe's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Introduction. In 2006, an important history book was published. Okay, obviously this is the summary author's introduction about the book. In 2006, an important history book was published, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, by Israeli historian and scholar Ilan Pappe. Ilan, I-L-A-N, P-A-P-P-E, pronounced Ilan Pappe. Although this important historical work documents one of the largest forced expulsions in modern history, the book has been ignored by the mainstream media in the United States. The story it tells is based on factual information from such sources as the Central Zionist Archives, the Israeli Defense Forces Archives, Rebirth and Destiny of Israel, a book by David Ben-Gurion, either a book or an article, the Haganah Archives. Haganah was the name of one of several armed militia groups, Jewish partisan groups in 1948, which committed many of the atrocities that Pappe writes about. The Haganah Archives, My Diary by Yosef Weitz, Red Cross and United Nations Archives, and Jewish authors such as Benny Morris and Avi Schleim. After the publication of his book, Pappe was forced out of his position as a professor at Tel Aviv University. He now lives in England, where he is a professor of history at the University of Exeter. I'm going to read that last sentence again. I'll probably remind people a number of times of it in the course of this reading. After the publication of his book, Ilan Pappe was forced out of his position as a professor, at Tel Aviv University in Israel. He now lives in England, where he is a professor of history at the University of Exeter. Continuing, why did Ilan Pappe write this book? First of all, he's a historian who values factual information. Derived from research using valid sources, in this case, the Zionist and Israeli military archives mentioned above. In the preface to The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, he writes, quote, "This book is written with a deep conviction that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine must become rooted in our memory and consciousness as a crime against humanity, end quote. Let me break for just a moment and say it is now 1602 hours Pacific Standard Time, 402 in Santa Cruz County, California. Returning to the introduction of the summary of the book. He aims to show, quote, how false and absurd was the Israeli claim that the Palestinians had left, quote, of their own accord, end quote. In the course of his research, Pape confirmed that Zionist and Israeli forces had committed a considerable number of atrocities, including massacres. His research destroys the myth that the Israelis had waged a moral war in 1948 against a well-armed Palestinian resistance movement. For instance, he writes about the, quote, poisoning of the water supply into the town of Acre with typhoid, numerous cases of rape, and the dozens of massacres the Jews perpetrated, end quote. In the preface, Pape continues, I want to make the case for the paradigm of ethnic cleansing and use it to replace the paradigm of war as the basis for the scholarly research of and the public debate about 1948. I am convinced, as my final pages show, that such a painful journey into the past is the only way forward if we want to create a better future for us all, Palestinians and Israelis alike. End quote. In short, Pape knows what we all know, that there are two sides to every story and that the Palestinian side has been ignored for more than 60 years. Most people know about the Nazi Holocaust and the importance of remembering it so that such atrocities will never happen again. According to Ilan Pape, we must simultaneously remember and acknowledge, quote, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, a crime against humanity that Israel has wanted to deny and cause the world to forget. Now, this is still the writer, the author of the summary, talking here. I flip the page. There's a picture of historic Palestine, which in this case is the so-called British Mandate of Palestine, which was established 2 years after the end of World War I. We have British Mandate Palestine. As of 1946, Palestinian loss of land is indicated by a smattering of white spots, both isolated and contiguous, mostly in northern and coastal Palestine, the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Very small, relatively small portions of Palestine in Jewish hands, Jewish-owned land. The summary continues. Terminology. Before continuing with this summary, let's look at the terminology used to ensure clarity and avoid stereotyping. First, what is Zionism? The term, which first appeared in 1896, refers to the movement to establish a Jewish national community in Palestine. There is, of course, nothing wrong with a nonviolent movement that seeks to establish a community that will peacefully coexist with indigenous inhabitants. The problem arises, however, when the establishment of such a community occurs at the expense of another people. It's important to point out that not all Jewish people consider themselves Zionists. I'm going to read that again. It's important to point out that not all Jewish people consider themselves Zionists. Organizations such as Jewish Voice for Peace and the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, or IJAN, either, consist of people who oppose the violence used in the establishment of in Palestine of an exclusively Jewish state of Israel. In addition, many Zionists themselves were not part of the violence against indigenous Palestinians. That is, the great majority of Zionists were not members of Zionist militias. This can be likened to the way in which many U.S. citizens opposed the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as their subsequent brutal occupations. It is 4:07. And please call me at 427-3772 or 469-3119. Direct to the studio here. You will be live on the air. Don't worry about interrupting me. I would like to get through the whole thing, the whole summary before the end of the show. Got about 45 minutes left. But by all means, call me at any point during the reading, in between the reading, etc. Okay, I think the summary part of the summary is, or excuse me, I think the introductory part of the summary is over, and now we're turning from the summary's author to the words of Ilan Pappe himself. The early years. The first colonizers arrived in Palestine in 1882. Pappe writes that, quote, Zionism secularized and nationalized, end quote, the traditions and religious views of Judaism. In addition, the early Zionists did not publicly acknowledge the existing population as existing inhabitants of what they called Eretz Israel, the religious name for Palestine. Even in 1918, however, the Zionist population of the country made up no more than 5%, 1 in 20, of the overall population. Rather than being a democratic movement, the objective became a theocratic state that would not tolerate the presence of non-Jews, even those whose ancestors had arrived there centuries ago. The expulsion of the indigenous Palestinian population was a goal early on. In 1897, Zionist Naaman Sirkin called for the expulsion of the indigenous population. That was 1897, my friends. In 1917, Zionist leader Leo Motzkin advocated both the, quote, resettlement of the Palestinian population outside of historic Palestine and the colonization of the entire area. He stated that the transfer of the population was both practical, quote, practical, and economical. Of course, such violent forced expulsions were nothing new when we look at the history of North and South America, Africa, and Australia, where outsiders routinely committed a series of atrocities, which are now collectively known as ethnic cleansing. And, just as previous expulsions were heavily based on economic considerations, many Zionists wanted the land, including its valuable resources, especially water, and knew that the, quote, real estate was potentially of high monetary value. Okay, so I think I'm starting to understand. The summary is essentially edited by my friend who put the summary together. So he's going to, I don't think we're going to turn over at any point in this little booklet here to portions of the booklet other than the quotations that he has. This is an edited summary of the book presented by my unnamed friend on behalf of the Palestine-Israel Action Committee here in Santa Cruz. Okay. Let's get the right page. Next section, systematic planning. The village files. Systematic planning for the eventual ethnic cleansing began with the establishment of the Jewish National Fund, JNF, in 1901. In addition to buying land for future Zionist colonies, the JNF ultimately conducted a registry of Palestinian villages, both Christian and Muslim, in order to provide detailed information on the inhabitants and physical characteristics of each village. The objective of the village files was to, one, record the topography of each village for future expulsion of its indigenous residents. Number two, access the, quote, Hebraic origins of each village. Number three, determine the age of each village. And number four, and assess the level of each village's participation in the 1936 uprising against the British occupation. And then parenthetically, in order to create a pretext for future killings and expulsions. Quote, particular attention was given to people who had allegedly, in italics, allegedly killed Jews, end quote. Emphasis added, the summary's author added the italics to the word allegedly. I'll read it again. Quote, particular attention was given to the people who had allegedly killed Jews. In 1948, this information was used by the Zionist militias to commit the worst atrocities, including torture and mass murder. British influence. When the Ottoman Empire, founded circa 1300 of the Common Era, he's formerly referred to as 1300 AD, when the Ottoman Empire fell, the British came in to fill the vacuum. And by the end of 1917, the British had reoccupied historic Palestine. The aspirations of the indigenous residents were ignored and were pushed aside as the British pursued their imperial goals. Simultaneously, the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur James Balfour, stated that the position of his government, which is to say, Great Britain would support, quote, the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, etc., end quote. The prejudice of the British government, I'm just going to move this way and get a little more light onto it, seems as though wearing glasses these days is not enough to help the old eyes read small print. Where was I? British influence, Ottoman Empire. The prejudice of the British government can already be seen in its reference to the Palestinians simply as, quote, non-Jewish. In the 1920s, the Palestinians comprised a majority of between 80 and 90% of the total population. Yet the British ignored this fact and treated the Zionists as if they made up half the population. Quote, until 1928, the British government had treated Palestine as a state within the British sphere of influence, not as a colony. A state in which, under British tutelage, the promise to the Jews and the aspirations of the Palestinians could both be fulfilled. In practice, however, British policy gave the advantage to the Zionist colonists and discriminated against the Palestinian majority, end quote. Even though the Palestinians grudgingly accepted the unfair idea of parity as a basis for negotiations, quote, the Zionist leadership rejected it. And again, this is around 1928. Zionist leaders were not going to accept the Palestinians as equals. After the 1929 Palestinian protest against the British, the government in London again seemed to support an even-handed approach. But the Zionist lobby worked behind the scenes to encourage the British occupiers to continue to favor the Zionist position. Of course, the Palestinians were upset with the unfair treatment, which made another uprising both justifiable and inevitable. In 1936, a popular rebellion was brutally suppressed. A popular rebellion was brutally suppressed by the British military, ending in the dismantling of the paramilitary forces, the Arabs, that, in their own defense, had fought the occupiers. In the late 1930s, the British actually had, in Mr. Pape's words, more troops in Palestine than there were in the Indian subcontinent. End quote. After 3 years of brutal attacks on Palestinians in the rural areas, many leaders of the rebellion were exiled and the vast majority of Palestinians were unarmed and unable to defend themselves. That phrase in italics, unarmed and unable to defend themselves, either against the British or later against the heavily armed Zionist militias. Now, in my words here, in Wren's words, I am Wren, the argument is made as a standard stock argument in favor of Israel that the Palestinians refused to accept the 1947 UN division of Palestine into a Jewish state area and a Palestinian state area, or Arab state area, as it was called, that the stubborn, hostile Palestinian Arabs would not consider a division of their homeland. Whereas Mr. Pape here is saying that even though the Palestinians grudgingly accepted the unfair idea of parity as a basis for negotiations, folks, for negotiations, Mr. Pape says the Zionist leadership rejected it. At that point in time, sometime in the 1920s, there was an example of intransigence on the part of the Zionist Jews. Okay, back to the summary. Partition. By 1937, the British Royal Peel Commission, that's P-E-P-E-E-L, British Royal Peel Commission, proposed the partition of Palestine into two states, and in public statements, public italicized, the Zionist leadership accepted the plan, which would give a modest portion of Palestine to a, quote, Jewish state, while they plotted in secret to forcibly take a much larger portion of the land, even if it meant, quote, transferring, end quote, the indigenous population through the use of violence, including terror. Again, the word transfer was used as a euphemism for violent expulsion. Again, I'm reading from a brief summary of Ilan Pape's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Ilan Pape is a Jewish man, former Israeli Jew, who lives in Great Britain now because he had no choice. The Israeli population was very unhappy with his literary work here. Remember to call me at 831-427-3772 or 831-469-3119 if you think I'm full of it or have questions about this. And folks, by the way, please remember this show is aired live once, as all live shows are aired once, whether you're talking radio, TV, or whatever, and made available on Free Radio Santa Cruz for later broadcast in the course of the week. Also, you, for those of you who go to websites like radioforall.net, radioforall.net, and find my Mideast Madness recordings of the shows there, just keep in mind you're listening to a recording. So now's the time to call, since it is January the 28th, 4:22 p.m. Pacific Time. If you want to call, call me now. Don't try and call during a rerun. Okay, next section. Zionist militias and the British military. Meanwhile, British authorities allowed the Zionist leadership to build, quote, an efficient military organization with the help of sympathetic British officers, etc., end quote, who formed an alliance with the Zionists against the Palestinian population. One officer in particular, Orde Wingate, with the help of those under his command, trained members of the main Zionist paramilitary organization, the Haganah, which I mentioned earlier in the show. Wingate coordinated the efforts of the Haganah and British forces with the objective of punishing Palestinians in the aftermath of the 1936 uprising and intimidating rural communities located close to Zionist settlements. That would be rural Arabic communities located close to Zionist, Jewish Zionist settlements. According to the Haganah archives of 1938, one of their units, along with British soldiers, attacked and briefly occupied a Palestinian village on the Lebanese border. This action served as a training exercise for future attacks. In the same Haganah archive, Zionist soldier Amatzia Cohen talked about the valuable bayonet training he received when he attacked those, quote, dirty Arabs, end quote, as he referred to Palestinian civilians. Members of the Haganah who gained experience in the British Army during World War II, I'll read that again, sorry. Members of the Haganah also gained experience in the British Army during World War II. British Jewish soldiers. Those who stayed in Palestine continued to infiltrate the 1,200 villages where most of the native population resided. Planning the expulsion accelerates. Joseph Weitz headed the JNF's Settlement Department. That's the Jewish National Fund's Settlement Department. His job was to plan the eviction of Palestinian tenant farmers from absentee-owned land. In 1940, Weitz made the following entries in his diary. The Arabs should go, and it is our right to transfer the Arabs. End quote. When Zionists purchased property, Weitz contacted the new owners to help them force the tenants out. 1943, which was during World War II, the village files became even more systematic in order to make the future expulsions more efficient. Information was collected not just on the basic characteristics of each village, but also on the ability of residents to defend themselves, whether there were guards or any weapons present. According to the Haganah's own archives, most villages had neither guards nor weapons after the British disarmament of 1936, which is to say the disarmament of the Arab Revolt of 1936. In addition, the British prohibited the acquisition of weapons by Palestinians in the years that followed. In 1937, David Ben-Gurion, who was a future prime minister of the new state of Israel, David Ben-Gurion wrote to his son, quote, "The Arabs will have to go, but one needs an opportune moment for making it happen," etc., end quote. Ben-Gurion's final solution depended on both force and opportunity. He knew that an exclusively Jewish state could not come about through the land purchase alone. Although Ben-Gurion wanted all of Palestine, he concluded that 80% would be enough to start with. 80% would be enough to start with, he says. Indeed, although the JNF did its best to purchase land from absentee owners, you know, like absentee landlords, the Zionists owned less than 6% of Palestine when the British pulled out in 1947. Let me read that again. Although Ben-Gurion wanted all of Palestine, he concluded that 80% would be enough to start with. 80%. Indeed, although the Jewish National Fund did its best to purchase land from absentee owners, the Zionists owned less than 6%. 6% of Palestine when the British pulled out in 1947. After World War II ended, the Zionist militias concentrated on attacking the British. Because the Palestinian leadership had collapsed and the Arab states did not seem to be interested in helping Palestinians. This would be in 1945, the middle of 45. In addition, the British were dismantling their empire as they were concentrating on rebuilding their economy after the war and establishing social programs at home. And there is a map on this page labeled United Nations Plan 1947, a division between land designated for a Palestinian state and then the white area is land designated for a Jewish state. That's a map that many of you are familiar with. Some of you are familiar with. And let me remind everyone that you can go to... I know we've got... Okay.
Where's that card that I was reading from? Rand, where'd you put the card?
The Resource Center for Nonviolence says our website is www.rcnv.org. And the Palestine-Israel Action Committee of Santa Cruz has got a website too, PIAC. You see, I see. There's an email address here to PIAC, PIAC@calcentral.com. If you're interested in one of these summaries, we still got well over 100 of them that we printed up. And you can either go to the RCNV website for more information or stop by the Resource Center for Nonviolence's new home at 612 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz. The old Christian Science Church, big white building, kind of churchy-looking building. No crosses, though, I don't think. And ask if anyone is there for you to ask. Most likely Anita or another staff member will be manning the building if it is open. About a $2 donation will be accepted so we can recoup the printing costs of these little brochures. And the brochure is simply called A Brief Summary of Ilan Pappé's Book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Or go to the website or write to PIAC at calcentral.com and ask exactly how you can get a hold of your copy and see these lovely black and white maps that spell the picture out a little better. And it is 4:31 Pacific Time. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. This is the military... keep doing it. This is the Mideast Madness Show. Don't ask me why I keep wanting to say military madness. I guess it rolls off my tongue more easily. Sometimes I want to say midnight madness. I think there are other shows on the Radio for All site that say midnight such and such. There's a show called Mellow Madness. But that doesn't roll off my tongue. So he says, this is Mideast Madness on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Okay. So, the British were dismantling their empire and concentrating on rebuilding their own more local economy and establishing social programs there. Weapons and militias. By the end of 1947, the Zionist militias consisted of about 50,000 troops, including auxiliaries that lived in the settlements. And the settlements they're talking about here, of course, as I break in, mean simply the land which was purchased by Jews before the establishment of the State of Israel. That's what these settlements are. By the end of 1947, the Zionist militias consisted of about 50,000 troops, including auxiliaries that lived in the settlements. By May 1948, the militias were augmented by small air force and navy, as well as tanks, armored vehicles, and heavy artillery. Palestinian forces consisted of only about 7,000 soldiers. That's what, about one-tenth the size of the Zionist militias? Palestinian forces consisted of only about 7,000 soldiers. In addition, by mid-1948, only about 3,000 reinforcements entered from other Arab countries. That would bring the Arab forces to one-fifth the size of the Zionist militias. Upon the founding of Israel in May 1948, the Israeli Communist Party received a large shipment of heavy arms from the Soviet Union, mostly from Czechoslovakia. I should point out that technically, the former nation of Czechoslovakia was not part of the Soviet Union. It was occupied as a so-called Iron Curtain country post-World War II. Eastern European country of Czechoslovakia. Slight correction from Wren here. Continuing. Simultaneously, Arab forces stopped receiving arms from Britain, making it impossible to defend themselves. By September 1948, the Israeli forces, the IDF, comprised 80,000 troops, from 50,000 to 80,000. Combined Arab forces never exceeded 50,000 poorly equipped men. Two additional extremist Israeli groups existed. The Irgun, which had split from the Haganah in 1931, and the Stern Gang, which in turn left the Irgun in 1940. Although the Irgun and the Stern Gang did not always coordinate with the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, as they called themselves, they contributed much to the effort to expel the Palestinians. Furthermore, special commando units, the Palmach, P-A-L-M-A-C-H, founded in 1941, around the beginning of World War II, helped expel Palestinians in rural areas until the militia disbanded at the end of 1948. New section, behind the scenes. Of course, the Zionist militias did not act on their own. They took their orders from a small group of leaders that Pape refers to as the, quote, consultancy, which is translated from the Hebrew words for consultant committee, an ad hoc cabal assembled solely for the purpose of plotting and designing the dispossession of the Palestinians. That this is Ilan Pape's own words, consultant committee, an ad hoc cabal assembled solely for the purpose of plotting and designing the dispossession of the Palestinians. The 11-member group's leader was David Ben-Gurion. Among others, membership consisted of Yigal Yadin, Moshe Dayan, Yigal Alon, and Yitzhak Sadeh. You may remember the name Moshe Dayan as the one-eyed general, had a patch over one of his eyes, who participated in after the establishment of Israel, also participated in the 1956 Suez Crisis War and the 1967 takeover by Israel of the remainder of Palestine and part of Syria, and at that time, Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Moshe Dayan, I'll never forget him. The secret planning for the ethnic cleansing began in earnest in 1947. Ben-Gurion, in his own words, wrote that there, quote, are no territorial boundaries for the future Jewish state, taken from his diary. Because Pape had access to Ben-Gurion's diary, the author was able to read summaries of the consultancy's secret and otherwise unrecorded meetings. The role of the United Nations. Simultaneously, the inexperienced, two-year-old United Nations, the UN, was planning the partition of Palestine. A special committee was set up, UNSCOP, which consisted of people who had neither prior experience dealing with similar situations nor any particular knowledge of the history of Palestine. At first, the committee considered making Palestine into one democratic state, which would allow the inhabitants self-determination. This idea was quickly abandoned in favor of partition into two states, with Jerusalem under international control, administered by the United Nations itself. That would be just Jerusalem administered by the UN. This plan was defined by General Assembly Resolution 181, which, quote, totally ignored the ethnic composition of the country's population. If the UN had apportioned the land dedicated to each future state, the Jewish part would have comprised, quote, no more than 10% of the land, end quote. Instead, and I quote, the Zionist movement was given, such as it were, a state that stretched over more than half of the country, end quotation. Palestinian leaders asked that the legality of the partition, quote, be tested in the International Court of Justice, which was founded in 1946. But this was never to happen. End quote. Thus, the Zionists were given more than half of the country, even though they owned less than 6% of the land. In addition, quote, the partition resolution, 181, incorporated the most fertile land in the proposed Jewish state, as well as almost all the Jewish urban and rural space in Palestine. Worse still, and this whole sentence here is italicized, 400 of the more than 1,000 Palestinian villages were located in the proposed Jewish state. And the author of the summary here puts an exclamation point at the end of that. I'll read those two sentences again. The partition resolution incorporated the most fertile land in all of Palestine in the proposed Jewish state, as well as almost all the Jewish urban and rural space in Palestine. Worse, 400 of the more than 1,000 Palestinian villages were located in the proposed Jewish state. In short, the UN favored an ideological movement that had already declared its goal to violently expel most of the indigenous human beings whose ancestors had lived there in most cases for centuries. New map, as of 2010, Palestinian loss of land is indicated by an almost all-white historic Palestine, which is marked as Jewish land, civil control and militarily controlled, and only the Gaza Strip and two mostly non-connected, non-contiguous blobs, like octopuses, out in the desert, are remaining Palestinian land, and even those are under Israeli military control. Most cases for centuries. Almost done, folks. Almost done with the program. Anyway, it's 4:41. We go until 4:55. Continuing with the role of the United Nations. When the 1947 UN map is examined, it reveals the following. And Mr. Pape is quoted here. On 42% of the land, 818,000 Palestinians were to have a state that included 10,000 Jews, while the state for the Jews was to stretch over almost 56% of the land, which 499,000 Jews were to share with 438,000 Palestinians. Now, listen again and pay close attention to these statistics. When the 1947 United Nations map is examined, it reveals the following. And this is according to General Assembly Resolution 181, the map they drew up. On Pape's words, on 42% of the land, 818,000 Palestinians were to have a state that included 10,000 Jews, while the state for the Jews was to stretch over almost 56% of the land, which 499,000 Jews were to share with 438,000 Palestinians. That's roughly 500,000. Half a million Jews were going to share the Jewish state with 438,000 Palestinians, end quote. Ilan Pape concludes that this partition plan, quote, contributed directly to the crime that was about to take place. It should be noted that the Palestinian leadership did boycott the UNSCOP UNSCOP negotiations. In hindsight, a huge mistake, according to my friend here who writes the summary of the book. In hindsight, a huge mistake. Yet the question must be asked, should Palestinians living today continue to suffer for the mistakes of their ancestors? In any case, the majority of Palestinians in 1947 opposed giving 56% of their land to the Zionist colonizers. The unfairness naturally resulted in resentment and mistrust. Pape says, Palestinians were at the mercy of UNSCOP, which ignored the goals of its own organization, international mediation. UNSCOP made the naive assumption that both sides would accept the situation and work things out peacefully. Resolution 181 included no mechanism to prevent the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. We're rolling right along here. We got 11 minutes. The final planning. Meanwhile, the consultancy was putting the finishing touches on its final planning. The first step in the expulsion consisted of a well-orchestrated campaign of threats. Special units of the Haganah entered villages and threatened violence to those Palestinians who might think of resisting. Village residents were warned to not cooperate with any resistance to the Haganah or to other Zionist militias. Resistance was met with the random killing of several residents. Zionist militiamen opened fire randomly on villagers, killing several in order to terrorize the rest so that all would flee. This was the same method used by the British in 1936 against the indigenous population of Arab Palestinians. Generally, a Zionist militia would enter a village around midnight, stay for a few hours, shoot anyone who left his home, and then depart. Is this not terrorism, it says here in parentheses? For example, the Palmach troops attacked the village of Kisas in northern Galilee on December 18, 1947, which was only about 2.5 weeks after the UN Resolution 181 partition. Militiamen blew up houses as the residents slept, killing 15, five of whom were children. Pape writes that the expulsion from the villages was extremely efficient. A few militiamen would enter a Palestinian village and round up a few Palestinian men, blindfold them, and shoot them to death. The bodies were tossed into a mass grave. Then the remaining villagers were told to leave immediately, or they would experience the same deadly treatment. The villages were usually blown up after the modest homes were looted. The Palestinians had nothing to return to and ultimately ended up in refugee camps. The urban areas were, of course, also targeted. The Irgun and Stern Gang were increasingly able to terrorize the Palestinians as the British gradually withdrew. Zionist settlers usually built their houses on the hills above a city. After the partition resolution was adopted by the UN in 1947, Palestinian areas of Haifa, the city of Haifa, were terrorized. Because Zionists were on higher ground, physically higher ground there, they could shell and snipe those below. They rolled barrels full of explosives down hills into Palestinian residential areas and poured oil mixed with fuel down roads, which they ignited. When Palestinians came out of their homes to extinguish the fires, the Zionist militiamen sprayed them with machine gun fire. The Haganah brought cars full of explosives to Palestinian repair shops. This is interesting. Listen. The vehicles there were blown up, killing innocent bystanders. Decades of cooperation between Zionist and Palestinian trade unionists ended when the Irgun began terrorizing their fellow Palestinian workers. Quotation, throwing bombs into Arab crowds was a specialty of the Irgun, according to the author. The British did nothing to protect Palestinians, and law and order collapsed as the British began to withdraw. In the first week of January 1948, the Irgun executed more terrorist attacks than at any previous time. January of 48. Last two paragraphs. Yigael Yadin, acting chief of staff of the Haganah and later head of the Israeli army, admitted that there was no need to wait for reaction from Palestinians. Instead, the Zionist militias needed, quote, to initiate preemptive strikes. Yigal alone went further, calling for, quote, collective punishments, even if there are children living in the houses that were to be attacked. Also, quote, Ben-Gurion ruled out any attempt to reach an agreement with Palestinians in Jaffa or anywhere else. Jaffa is the present-day Israeli city of Tel Aviv. Ben-Gurion ruled out any attempt to reach an agreement with Palestinians in Jaffa or anywhere else. Shulamit Aloni, a female Israeli officer and civil rights advocate, later recalled that special political officers would actively incite the troops by demonizing the Palestinians and invoking the Holocaust, end quote, in order to incite the militiamen before they began their attacks on villages. Last paragraph. The consultancy finalized their plan in March of 1948. The mission took 6 months to complete. When it was over, and someone is calling me. Hello, you're on the air. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, I have a question. I'm usually with this other guy, but are you playing your radio station right now? Or is this the radio station?
This is the station, and we're on a hot mic. You're on the air.
I'm on the air.
What is your issue?
They want me to put a song on, but I don't know if it's here. I think I got the wrong number, probably.
Well, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Did you want another show, maybe, on Free Radio?
Probably that's what it is. I'm not sure. Okay, now I'm lost. It's okay. Let me figure it out, and then I'll call back.
Okay, well, stay tuned in. We also have musical shows on Free Radio.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, well, I must ask for your forgiveness. Here I am boasting about how anyone who calls will be on the air, and we get a totally non sequitur off of the subject topic. That happens, and that's free radio for you. Okay, last paragraph. I'll read the whole thing again. The consultancy finalized their plan in March of 1948. The mission took 6 months to complete. Quote, when it was over, more than half of Palestine's native population, close to 800,000 people, had been uprooted, 531 villages had been destroyed, and 11 urban neighborhoods emptied of their inhabitants. The plan decided upon on 10 March 1948, and above all, its systematic implementation in the following months was a clear-cut case of an ethnic cleansing operation regarded under international law today as a crime against humanity. So says Ilan Pape. Yet Pape writes that the expulsion, quote, has ever since been systematically denied and is still today not recognized as an historical fact, let alone acknowledged as a crime that needs to be confronted politically as well as morally. That is the end of the summary of Ilan Pape's book, his 2006 published book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. This document, the summary, is published by the Palestine-Israel Action Committee of the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz, California, 95060, and was edited by my friend. I will continue to withhold his name. The document may be copied and distributed in the hope that peace and justice will prevail in historic Palestine and elsewhere in the region. Might I throw in the fact that this broadcast may be distributed, copied and distributed in the same hope. When copied, please make no revisions and include this notice. The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine was first published in 2006 by One World Publications Limited, 13:978-1-85168-555-4. For additional information or to make a contribution to RCNV, please visit rcnv.org. Well, we did it with a minute to spare. This is Mideast Madness. The show comes to you live Monday of every single week. At 1500 hours, 3 p.m., 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I will not have time to add more personal notes, and yes, I did add a number of explanations and such in the reading of the summary. Also, keeping your thoughts, prayers, and donation dossiers, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper's group. He was the author of the article I read from The Israeli Elections, The Ball Is in Our Court. Boycott SodaStream. Do not buy SodaStream. It's a baddie. Well, this was a very important episode of Mideast Madness, considering we went through the entire local summary of Ilan Pape's book. I always want to say Ian Pape's or Ian's. Ilan Pape's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I do hope people listen to the, you know, rerun of this show. But until I commit a greater success in the building up of this show's listening audience, all I can do is spit into the wind and say, gee, I hope it'll happen. This is Rent Wheel. Palestine Today from the IMEMC is next. Have a great week.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, January 28, 2013. A worker dies in a siege-busting tunnel in Gaza, and settlers erect a new settlement in northern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources in the Gaza Strip reported on Sunday that a Palestinian man was killed and another was injured in a tunnel accident in Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. The accident took place in a siege-busting tunnel in As-Salam neighborhood in Rafah. One resident was also injured. The body of the slain Palestinian, aged 33, and the wounded resident were moved to Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah.